Hey there, it's Michelle Norris. I'm host of a podcast called Your Mama's Kitchen. When I travel, I'm usually looking for a way to find a taste of home when I'm not at home. And one of the things I love to do when I am at home is entertain. And Airbnb allows me to do that. When I was in California recently, I rented a house that had a great kitchen. And when we were sitting around the table, we're all thinking, we're in someone else's house. Someone could be in all of our homes as well. If you have a home, but you're not always at home, you have an Airbnb. Your home might be worth more than you think. Find out how much at airbnb.com/host.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Hello, I'm Matt Kelly.
And I'm Matt D'Ancona.
And this is the Two Matts for the week ending Friday, the 23rd of February, a podcast brought to you by the New European Newspaper. What did we talk about? What should we call this episode?
Well, it's we led off on Ukraine, really, didn't we? And yeah. It's the 2-year anniversary. So I suppose it's we need to talk around that.
Yeah, and the poison of Putin.
The poison of Putin.
Yeah.
That's not so bad. Sure. I mean, is there an anniversary, Ukraine's bitter anniversary, or...
What's going to get more clicks? That's all I care about.
We hate clickbait, but we love it.
We love clickbait,
yeah,
but we hate it.
But we deplore it.
What would get more clicks, do you think? The poison of Putin or your lame idea?
I have a feeling we're tending towards the poison of Putin. You know, I have a kind of it's intuition. My shamanistic powers of intuition.
Well, I'll go with whatever you think, Matt.
Let's go with the power of Putin.
The
boss
poison
Matt.
Of Putin.
The poison of Putin.
Okay. Fantastic.
All right, the poison of Putin.
Okay, so this is the Two Matts, episode 33, The Poison of Putin.
Enjoy.
Enjoy. So, Matt, what are we talking about this week?
Well, I think given the imminence of the second anniversary of the invasion of Ukraine, we should really talk about that.
Amazing just to pause and think it is two years.
It is. And I thought it might be interesting as a way of sort of framing this to go back to Biden's State of the Union address in March 2022, which was just after the invasion on February the 24th. And you get a taste there of how we saw it then in the West. So let's maybe produce a Mac and give us a blast of that.
When the history of this era is written, Putin's war in Ukraine will have left Russia weaker and the rest of the world stronger. Well, it shouldn't have taken something so terrible for people around the world to see what's at stake. Now everyone sees it clearly. We see the unity among leaders of nations, a more unified Europe, a more unified West. We see unity among the people who are gathering in cities and large crowds around the world, even in Russia, to demonstrate their support for the people of Ukraine. In the battle between democracy and autocracies, democracies are rising to the moment.
So that was 2 years ago.
Yes, and he went on to talk about, you know, how history will recall this as a great moment. And
have democracies risen to?
Well, this is the thing: is that I think there's some very interesting psychology at work here, which is that the background is that America thought privately that Russia would win very quickly, and General Mark Milley, who we've talked about on the pod before, the chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff at the time, was telling congressmen in early February 2022 that the Russian military might win in 72 hours.
Yeah.
So then what happens is there's a huge surprise, which is Russia doesn't win quickly. And we overcorrect in the West. I think that's what happened. And I went back looking at what I wrote at the time, and it's interesting because I was troubled at the time by what I called the group hug in the West. There was a kind of, free world united, Putin bound to lose, Putin, you know, Russia clearly on the verge of industrial and military collapse, and a lot of self-congratulation, frankly, which, you know, verged on hubris and was treating the victory as a fait accompli in the first weeks of what. And, you know, there were some good there were some good things. I mean, do you remember the convoy leading to Kiev, that long convoy leading down south to Kiev? Yeah. And it was halted, you know, and then there were a series of victories, you know, in Kharkiv and then in Kherson, and you know, there was reason to feel that Putin might be, you know, halted, brackets, finished off.
Yeah.
And then it turned. And suddenly, last year, 2023, there was, you know, defeat in Bakhmut. And then the much vaunted summer counteroffensive by Ukraine didn't really...
Didn't happen.
Didn't happen.
Didn't, no.
And then very recently, the capture of... by Russian troops of Avdiivka.
Mm-hmm.
And then you've had things like Zelensky firing his top general, Valery Zeluzhny, who had written this, who wrote this extraordinary long article in The Economist, sort of criticizing, you know, it's a very odd way to do it, very public way to criticize their own strategy. And I think Zeluzhny has ambitions to become president. So that was, suddenly there were cracks in the Ukrainian regime, let alone in the West. And Putin bounces back.
Yeah.
You know, I remember us talking about Evgeny Prigozhin, the Wagner Group's guy back in June. He failed coup. Was this, but, you know, Putin had not done anything about him immediately.
Mm.
And then in August he did. You know, there was Prigozhin died in a plane crash.
He's very much a dish served cold man, isn't he?
He is, absolutely. Yeah. And, you know, we've seen horribly and only recently the murder of Alexei Navalny.
Yeah.
We don't know precisely what the proximate causes were, but it's pretty clear what happened.
Yeah.
And Russia is not just sort of, you know, still in the game, but actually reviving.
Its economy is good, isn't it?
Its economy, you know, it's found a way around many of the sanctions, if not most.
Yeah.
We haven't banned a lot of things like metals. You know, EU's paying a lot of money to Russia for gas. Also, Russia's upped its manufacturing capability.
Yeah.
It's bringing in weapons from Iran and China and so on. And I think the crucial thing is that Zelensky and the West underestimated the capacity of the Russians under an autocracy to withstand casualties.
Yeah, so for that level of attrition.
That level of attrition, you know, they are capable. And you know,
as it was Stalin that said, when talking about the difference between quantity and quality, he said quantity has a quality all of its own.
Absolutely.
And they've got a lot of people.
And they've got a lot of people. And I don't think Putin is planning to do another wave of mass mobilization before the elections, in inverted commas, in March, but I'm sure he will afterwards.
Yeah.
And just a worrying statistic about the Ukrainian forces is that the average age of the soldiers on the front is 43, the Ukrainians.
Wow.
Now that for a infantry force is way high, you know, way high. And so you know, I don't know about you, but I find myself extremely apprehensive. We can go on to talk about the West, but just the sort of state of play.
Well, it just feels like there's no exit now for either party, really. It's just an atrocious conflict that has been normalised, that the focus, all the emotion from the public has dissipated. You know, you can remember 2 years ago, everybody flying Ukrainian flags and, you know, the huge swathe of goodwill, front pages dominating everywhere, and a great sense of optimism that here finally was they'd picked on the wrong people, you know, and Zelensky is this figurehead of defiance. I remember that being a front page we did with Zelensky's face and the headline Defiance. The spirit of Ukraine, and that was very, and I still think that is the case. They are defiant, but defiance only gets you so far.
Yes,
you know they need help.
They're totally dependent upon essentially Europe and America.
Well, and America obviously got this £60 billion package promised to them.
Yeah,
which is stuck in Congress.
It's stuck in Congress for the most tawdry of ideological reasons, which is you know, to cut to the chase, because Trump doesn't want it to get through, because Trump is hoping to win in November and to do a deal with Putin, which would, you know, end the support for Zelensky and give Putin, I imagine, a huge swathe of Ukraine. But also, Biden talked about Western unity. Well, it, actually, that has not lasted, and Europe is divided, and not just because of Orban. You know, there's this whole big argument going on now about there's $300 billion worth of frozen Russian assets. And there's an argument about let's seize them and put them into Ukrainian hands. Let's give them the money for weaponry, or some people say it should be used for reconstruction. I think the former is better. Mm. But there is a genuine argument about that. And the French in particular have been very, you know, in spite of Macron talking about a European security identity, which is absolutely right. In practice, at Munich, he was absent, and there was very little of that.
And just explain Orban's role in this, then.
Well, Viktor Orban is, you know, has been in charge of Hungary for a long time, and he is, you know, he's a cuckoo in the nest in Europe, because he is essentially a Putin, well, he is a Putin supporter, and he's blocking anything and everything that he can from the EU. And so, you know, although the Brits have done very well and helping, we could do more, but you know, the EU is a huge block, and you know, Orban has encouraged the division essentially between East and West, actually, because, not needless to say, the countries that are nearer to Russia feel more strongly about this than those to the west of the continent. So and Putin is relishing all this, as you would, because A, he's waiting for the November election and hoping that Trump will win. But I think it's not, you know, Trump's recent remarks about NATO have been disgraceful, you know, saying he would invite Russia to, you know, do what the hell it liked with
anyone who doesn't pay,
their fair share, right? I mean, this is disgusting. Yeah. But, you know, would that it were just MAGA and Trump, but it isn't. You know, that there is a general trend in America away from being the global policeman, away from the Pax Americana. I mean, you know, never forget, it was Biden who pulled his forces and therefore the allies out of Kabul at speed in August 2021, you know, and he is, he's made it clear from the start, no more forever wars. No boots on the ground or Western or American involvement in this conflict.
And just to put some sort of broader historical, to take the perspective back a bit, actually, that position for America is far truer to the founding fathers' vision of America than what happened since World War II, isn't it?
Exactly. I mean, people act as if America First is a Trumpite invention. It really isn't.
It's a George Washington invention.
Exactly. Yeah. The classic text is his 1796 farewell address, which says, don't get involved with foreign entanglements, guys.
And famously, they kind of let the French down, didn't they? Having had the French support in their War of Independence, they then didn't get involved with a war against Britain and France, right? Am I right?
Yes, and also, you know, the what we called the Pax Americana, and you know, the involvement in America and all over the world in conflicts, proxy conflicts, was very much a feature of the Cold War, and it survived the end of the Cold War to an extent, because you know, Clinton got involved in some interventions, and then of course George W. Bush got involved in two huge wars, so it continued. But those, you know, Iraq and Afghanistan were not popular in America, particularly by the end. Anything that can be labelled a forever war polls incredibly badly in America.
Tracing back to Vietnam, I guess.
Right? I think Vietnam was where it started. Yep. I totally agree. You know, which is much on people's minds at the moment, and this is all understandable.
So you've got a populace in America, which actually doesn't represent the view we've got of Americans as Europeans, Americans being the big kind of brother who will adhere, will look after everybody, will pay for everything, will underpin our security in Europe, which is the reality.
Yes.
And this is what Trump's railing against, isn't he? Saying
he is.
You guys need to pay.
But unfortunately for us, for global security, for the universal, you know, rules-based order,
yeah,
it isn't just Trump.
Yeah.
You know, he is the most vulgar, crude, disgraceful spokesperson of that view.
Yeah.
But it is broader than that.
Yeah.
And we have to, in Europe, kind of adjust to this and right quick, because I think that whatever happens in November, the world has to, Europe has to cope with the fact that America is not going to carry on being what it used to be. And, you know, the thing that you hear a lot from Americans of all persuasions is, why should we pay for the world's defense to subsidize Europeans' capacity to have a generous welfare state?
Right.
Now, that may be unfair. I don't know. But that is how they see it.
Yeah.
Which is...
And it's certainly an argument that you could, you know...
You can see how it flies.
And, you rightly describe Trump, the way he frames the proposition is disgusting and violent and scary as hell. However, the point that, you know, they pay disproportionately more to look after European security is true.
So, it's unarguable.
So then, you know, Paul Mason wrote a piece in the New York.
I mean, one thing just to say in parenthesis is that anyone who hasn't bought or read or, you know, get the New European this week, because it has three fantastic pieces on Ukraine.
Yeah.
And I think Paul Mason's magisterial piece.
It was brilliant, wasn't it?
It's like it's one of those must read, cut out and keep pieces.
I'm always proud of the New European, but I was particularly proud of it
was a great
this
issue.
Week.
Great issue.
And Paul very strongly made the point, which is, you know, you can wave all your placards, you can do all of your demos and all of this stuff. You know, and we should talk about the chaos in the House of Commons last night, not about Ukraine, but about Israel and Palestine. But you can do all of that. But it, at the end of the day, if you're not prepared to step up and pay for the weaponry and to really put your shoulder behind Ukraine, it means nothing. And that's inarguable, isn't it?
I think that one of the points that Paul made, and I totally agree with, is that what is at stake here is not just the sovereignty of Ukraine, but a very, very big principle about not just the conflict between the free and authoritarian worlds, but, you know, North Korea and China are watching very hard to see, as is Iran, what happens here. How, you know, what is Western nerve like? And if you don't care about the people of Ukraine or of Hong Kong or of Taiwan, then worry about global food security, worry about supply chains. You know, that, and also, I think, you know, this podcast is brought by the New European. Now, if we don't believe in the international rules-based order,
then what do we?
And there is a tendency, and it is almost everywhere now, to kind of recoil from supranationalism and supranationalist reality at exactly the moment when we should be thinking about it more. You know, I'm naive. I thought COVID would make people think everything is connected.
Yeah.
Everything is related.
This is a one world situation.
Right. Yeah. You know, and I thought it would have great read across to consciousness of climate change. Couldn't have been more wrong.
Yeah.
It turned into a nationalist competition, who could get the vaccine first, not vaccine sharing. There was almost no real supranationalism to come out of it, which is an absolute tragedy.
Yeah.
But I agree with Paul. I think, you know, we have to frame this conflict in Ukraine is not an exercise in charity. It's about collective self-preservation.
Right.
And I also think that there's a longer-term problem, which is, again, connected to climate change, pandemic resilience and so on, which is that in the West, we've kind of lost our sense of the long haul. You know, we've lost that idea of being on a war footing. And there was a poll I saw this week, which is came, I think, from the Council on Foreign Relations, which is just 10% of Europeans believe we can win in Ukraine.
Yeah.
That's a terrifying figure. And it's like, to go back to what Biden said, wars of conflicts are now treated like retail products or consumer items. You know, like, we look for instant gratification. Unless they're over in a week or 2 weeks.
Yeah. People get bored.
People get bored and they lose interest and faith. And the truth is that a lot of wars last a very long time. I mean, it's worth mentioning that the Korean War is not actually officially ended yet. Right. It has, but it's an armistice, right? There's been no. So, we have to understand that if you want to win in Ukraine, this may take a while.
Yeah, it strikes me. I don't know whether this is a good analogy or not, but it feels like the geopolitical system's a little bit like plate tectonics.
Yeah.
You know, it's like the cracks are always there. The Earth might be still for a while, but the cracks are still there, yeah, and you're just waiting for them to rupture in, yes, some way. And, yeah, you know, we've currently got a rupture, and how long that lasts, who knows?
It's impossible to say. And, you know, but what is certainly true is that at the moment, and in a way that people did not predict in 2022, Putin is in the driving seat again.
For sure.
And so, okay, let's try not to be too dismal about it. What can be done? What, you know, it's not stalemate. It's positional warfare, which is just a jargon for, you know, two defensive lines kind of facing a war of attrition. But we haven't reached stalemate. There are things that can be done. We need to massively increase Ukraine's air power. Massively. It's getting 18 F-16s, and it's, you know, pilots are going to be trained in the US over the summer, but that needs to be speeded up and intensified radically. You know, yeah, they need aircraft, they need ammunition. I mean, Zelensky said that in their recent difficulties, one of the problems has been that when you think about it, is unbelievable that the hold up in Congress with those MAGA idiots holding the money hostage, the $60 billion, that has actually led, A, to Putin feeling emboldened, but B, to put it in sort of brass tacks, having to ration ammunition,
yeah,
on the front. You know, there are Ukrainian fighters who don't have the ammunition and the armor they need because in Washington,
yeah,
there are these America First MAGA Republicans playing games.
And I think it was in Paul's piece, there was a few pieces in the paper, but I think it was in Paul's piece again that he said a mate of his who'd been called up in Ukraine, because Paul spent quite a bit of time in Ukraine and in the east of Europe, had sent him a photograph of the rifle he'd been issued, and it was made in 1944.
That's a great detail, and it told you so much, which, yeah, is that, you know, we have in our stockpiles in the West huge quantities of armaments that could be got to Ukraine within weeks, and they're not. And of course, part of the problem here is that at the beginning of the war, we did what you should never do in any form of conflict, which is reveal your hand immediately. So Garry Kasparov, I remember, said, bear in mind that Putin does not play chess, he plays poker.
Right.
But at the very start, Biden and Johnson and then Truss briefly and Sunak have always emphasized no Western involvement in, we won't go any further than that.
Yeah.
Now, that's probably true,
yeah,
but you don't need to spell it out. You don't start a counteroffensive by saying, by the way, Vladimir,
we're not going to hit you.
Don't worry, yeah, you know.
But we'd rather you didn't. We'll try and help him hit you.
You never reveal your hand. You never reveal your hand. You know, the implication of it was that if we did so, we would be risking nuclear war, which is always true in our relations with nuclear armed countries, of which there are quite a few now.
Yeah.
But we kind of have to make you can't split the difference decision here, which is there's a cruelty to Ukraine if, in fact, what we're going to do is virtue signal and salve our consciences and say, we're helping Ukraine, Slava Ukraine, you know, and have concerts and blue and yellow pendants and things like that. But actually, what we're going to do eventually is force them to cut a deal.
Yeah.
If that's the case, and I really hope it isn't, but if that is the case, then the sooner the better.
Well, it would be much kinder to be honest with people. So, because there's people dying all the time.
Yeah. All the time. You know, if actually where this is heading is the West backing down, then we should tell Zelensky, look, you know, you've got until July, and then we're going to cut a deal, but you're going to lose a lot of territory.
Presumably the reason we don't do that is not international politics, but domestic, because it plays both, really badly. You know,
we want to not get involved in wars, but look very strong militarily, which is ridiculous paradox. And I think there is a sort of crisis of confidence and of identity in the West at the moment, which is, what do we actually believe in as far as international rules-based order? You know, what do we, you know, how far are we willing to go?
Yeah.
And I think part of it is that there's a generation of leaders who grew up with the Cold War, then 1989, and fell into the trap. And I think I probably did to some extent, you know, thinking, oh, that's a nice peace now. And didn't think, you know, Russia is innately unstable. It needs 50 Marshall plans. It needs, you know, don't just throw at Jeffersonian democracy. Mm. You know, invest, you know, give it the infrastructure that can turn it into a decent civil society as well as just a notional democracy. But we didn't. Mm. And we are now reaping the rewards of that. And also, Western societies after the end of the Cold War started to wind down their defense spending. And yet now in 2024, we find ourselves in a world that is more disorderly, you know, more fractal. There are more threats from more directions.
I can remember conversations, I mean, going back 10, 15 years, where people were saying, and people in the military, and the defense secretary saying, you know, the next wave of defense expenditure and investment won't be in tanks and planes. It'll be in cyber war. You know, this is where the threat's coming from.
And there's
from.
A truth in that. You know, there's an element of truth.
But now we're talking about, bloody hell, we need to, where are all the Challenger tanks? Well, we've sent them already.
Exactly. and look, the cruel truth about wars for territory is that in the end, you need infantry.
Yeah.
You know, you can, and there's no doubt that Ukraine has been, it's a sort of multi-layered war, because on the one hand, you know, as you say, it's got 1944 rifles and moments of entrenchedness which resemble the First World War, but it's also had amazing drone technology. You know, Ukrainians, so entrepreneurial, using 3D printers to make drones and using drones. I mean, they've actually innovated in warfare because they've used drones at sea. They don't have a navy.
Like drone torpedoes, aren't they?
Yeah, and they've used drones at sea. They're really amazing. To keep Putin at bay around Crimea in the sea. So, I mean, that is an amazing achievement. But one of the things that's been happening recently is that Russia is now pulling ahead again in signal jamming technology. So, you know, we need to help there. But, I mean, in the end, you're right, which is like this relies on ammunition kit, aircraft, anti-tank battery assault kit, and whatever it takes to give Ukrainian people on the front what they need to fight, or not.
Yeah. I know hindsight's obviously the greatest gift to man, but looking back, there was a period, and for more than a decade, where Putin was treated as a partner.
Yes.
And was given succor, you know, and was brought to the table and embraced, and all of those famous dialogues with Merkel and with Blair.
Absolutely.
And on and on it went.
And Blair was particularly insistent that we had to keep Putin at the table because of the fight against ISIS.
That's right.
I remember Anne Applebaum, now of The Atlantic, whose husband, Radek Sikorski, is now back in the Polish government, saying almost immediately after Putin was appointed and with Yeltsin's patronage, this guy's no good.
Yeah.
You know, he's FSB, ex-KGB. He's a thug. He will crush the oligarchs or tame them. And he's an autocrat in waiting who wants to recreate Greater Russia. And she wrote this, and the pieces are all there to be read, you know, way back to when Putin started. And everyone said, no, Putin's the new thing. You know, he's a modernizer. And Anne was right.
What a historic mistake.
It was a historic mistake. And I think that it was confirmation bias, really, because we wanted to believe that this, because he was quite young when he took over. I mean, it's a long 25 years ago now.
Yeah.
We wanted to believe that somehow he was, you know, he represented a younger generation of Russians, whereas actually Putin is a very ancestral, you know, traditional figure.
And if you look, I mean, we've talked often about the checklist for fascists. He ticks everyone in spades.
He ticks everyone. He believes, you know, passionately. I mean, I think one of the, again, classic Western error, which was to think this is all about the respective economies. You know, the Western economy will beat the Russian economy. And that, of course, is true up to a point. It's always true in war. But to an extent, I think people underestimated in February 2022, this is a war about ideas as well.
Yeah.
So the Ukrainians have really solidified in their sense of Ukrainian national identity. You know, they will not yield on that. This conflict has given them a sense that, no, you know, we're not going to be drawn back into the Russian Empire.
Yeah.
But on the other side, you have Putin, who's, you know, as he showed in that insane interview with Tucker Carlson,
yeah,
he really believes in this sort of quasi-mystical greater Russia. Yeah. Idea, you know, which is deeply connected with the Orthodox faith and with history, a slightly bowdlerized version of history. But he does.
Yeah.
He really
yeah.
does.
And by the way, if anyone wants to see that dangerous idiot or useful idiot Tucker Carlson brought down to size,
John Stewart.
Check out the John
isn't
Stewart
it great?
Clip on YouTube, on Twitter or wherever you...
By the way, isn't it great to have John Stewart back properly?
Fantastic.
Because I know he did an Apple TV series, which is all right.
Yeah,
but this, you know, and I know people are saying, oh, it's not as good as it used to be, you know,
yeah.
As they always do. But actually, that takedown...
Absolutely magnificent.
It's on YouTube.
Yeah. It's about 5 minutes and it's some of the best takedown
you'll
ever see.
He just says, aren't you just a dick?
Yeah. he really is such a dick. By the way, I mean, one interesting fact that I had no concept of is that clearly Americans have not got shopping trolleys with coins in them.
I love that moment.
Tucker Carlson is incredulous at this idea.
This is incredible.
That
you can actually put some rubles into your...
It's actually free,
yeah,
but there's an incentive to return it and not just take it to your homeless encampment. Absolute arsehole.
He is, and of course now, gloriously, yeah, at the time of recording, he's engaged in a spat with TV's Boris Johnson.
Yes.
over whether or not Boris asked for...
Yeah, who wants to be a millionaire?
$1 million for their interview. You know, I kind of believe Tucker on that one.
Yeah,
I mean,
yeah.
You know, that has the ring of truth, doesn't
Absolutely
it?
Absolutely does. Listen, just before, because we're going to switch up in the second half to a fantastic series of television dramas.
Yeah,
that
have changed
politics in many ways. But before we do, what the fuck happened yesterday in the comments?
Well, yeah, it's funny because I was out watching Dune 2 and then I got out and I had a text from you saying...
Absolute
everything's
scenes.
Gone crazy.
Yeah.
So I checked it out. Okay. Well, let's not... I have to go into the weeds a little bit.
Yeah.
But I'll try not to go too much into the weeds because it's outside the weeds that matters.
Yeah.
Briefly, there's... In the parliamentary system, there are 20 days set aside every parliamentary session called opposition days, which just means the opposition parties get the chance, they get control of the order paper. And Labour gets 17 and the Scottish National Party gets 3 days. And yes, and the day, Wednesday, was the day that the SNP had the, and they had this very strongly worded motion on a ceasefire.
Yeah. Which was kind of unambiguous, wasn't it?
Unambiguous,
yeah,
and very crisp, and you know, yeah, it was to the point. And Labour was, as we know, torn over this, and they drew up their own amendment, which called for a ceasefire, but hedged it around with lots of conditions, including, and this is the key phrase, Israel cannot be expected to cease fighting if Hamas continues with violence, and that Israelis have the right to assurance that the horror of 7th of October cannot happen again, which means they call for a ceasefire without calling for a ceasefire.
Yeah, yeah.
So that was the situation. Now, so what happens is, and again, we're back in the weeds, the rules of an opposition day motion are that the opposition party, in this case CNM, makes the pitch,
mm-hmm,
and then the government amends it, and they vote on both.
Yeah.
What Lindsay Hoyle said,
the speaker, well, yeah,
the Speaker of the House said, was, well, actually, there's some nuance here. We should call Labour's motion as well.
Yeah.
So there'd be three votes. Now, this is a breach of protocol. And it was interesting that his advisor, Tom Goldsmith, wrote him immediately saying, this is not how things should be done.
Yeah.
And I suppose that's true, although it is, as Tom Goldsmith admitted, the Speaker does have discretion. This
yeah.
is only a convention, okay,
yeah,
to be fair to Hoyle. So what was really going on? So what happened was the SNP and the Tories flounced out, and all that happened was...
But that's critical, isn't it? That the Tories... And what I don't think has been discussed quite enough is that the Lindsay Hoyle says, or I think had an expectation, that the Tories would turn up to to vote. So, but they didn't. The Tories said, well, the hell with this, and went...
This is very... I mean, the whole thing, I'm sure, brought back Vietnam veteran memories of Brexit. Certainly did for me.
Yeah.
Because I think what Lindsay Hoyle hoped was that there'd be three votes.
Exactly.
On the SNP, on Labour, and then the government amendment.
Exactly.
And that everyone would have the chance to
And they
vote.
Could all... And again, the bigger point he said in his head was that people are being threatened.
Well, this is...
And that they're being endangered, and they need to have the opportunity to say exactly what they feel.
Now we're at the bone, which I think is deeply troubling, which is... I don't... Actually, I'm not actually as critical as some people have been, Lindsay Hoyle, of feeling that as leader of the House, as Speaker of the House, he had to be mindful of the security of his MPs, right? Because he wanted to give them an opportunity in the Labour amendment to say that they were for a ceasefire, but not in the very bald turns of the SNP motion.
Yeah.
I am very troubled by the idea that Parliament, and this is where I think it stops being about procedure and Masonic ritual and shouting, and actually gets into the way that this conflict is dividing nations and societies and the world. It is, you know, as I hear constantly from young people, you know, it is the Vietnam of our time.
Yeah. I mean, dividing them to the point where it's becoming extreme. That's the
That's right. I mean, I mean, again, to be fair to Hoyle, I mean, first of all, we know from recent history that MPs' security has become an issue generally. So Joe Cox in the Brexit campaign, David Amos killed in 2021, Mike Freer, the MP for Finchley and Golders Green, saying he's not going to stand again because of all the threats of violence. And I know anecdotally, since October 7th, I've spoken to MPs of both Tory and Labour who have received death threats over this. You know, unless you stand up for the Palestinians, you know, we're going to kill you, we're going to kill your kids. Now,
unbelievable.
That is really terrible. So I have a measure of sympathy for Lindsay Hoyle for thinking I have to respond to this. But, there are more important to me than what the rules are governing opposition days is that we've reached a point where the Speaker of the House feels that he has to set the procedure of the business that day in the House according to the physical risk.
The mob that could descend.
This is not good. Not to speak of the fact that wherever you stand on what's going on in Gaza, you know, it is obviously something that should be discussed at length and with as many variations as possible. You know,
I'll say something controversial. Yeah. The mob might descend on me, but let's keep it in bloody perspective as well.
Yes.
That what goes on in Westminster and these people making their placards and going on their marches and chanting their chants affects nothing in the cabinet of Israel, or nothing in the destruction in Gaza. It has no consequence. It is sound and fury signifying nothing in this particular example.
We are not a very significant player in this.
No.
We are part of the diplomatic mix.
We've got our seat at the Security Council. Maybe that will count for something
one day.
But only if America tells us what to say.
You know, on the same day, Israel's Knesset, its parliament, passed a resolution saying, no, we're not going to have a two-state solution.
Yeah.
Now, that's a decision.
That's something.
Right?
Yeah.
You know, and meanwhile, I don't know what the death toll in Gaza was yesterday, but I imagine it was very high.
Yeah.
You know, those are the two salient facts from yesterday.
I find it really, really increasingly tedious seeing the number of people, journalists included, who are making a very good living, actually, from whipping people up into a fury about an issue where they have no influence and no semblance of any change. Now, I know journalists' job is to write about what's going on in the world and to try and explain it. But when you do it from such a polarized position, in the full knowledge that you are intensifying people's rage, I find that really hard to stomach. You know?
Totally. And to sort of tie it into Ukraine, again, we need the perspective of the long haul, because I think any decent person can agree that, you know, the ideal outcome of all this at some point, somewhere down the line, is peace and a two-state solution.
Yeah, exactly.
Right? A viable Palestinian state recognised by the world and a secure Israel.
Right.
But the fact is we are a long way away yeah. from that. And the idea that because the SNP want there to be a ceasefire, and I understand that, you know, that Benjamin Netanyahu is going to say, oh, okay,
yeah.
and there'll be a ceasefire, and then they'll immediately go into talks in Oslo.
Shit,
about,
guys, have you seen the lads in Dundee? Aren't
yeah,
happy?
I mean, God, you know,
it's
hey,
winded
check
in.
This out, Benny. You know, it's ridiculous.
Yeah. Yeah. All right.
And it's embarrassing.
It's just mortifying.
It is mortifying.
Selling a little or a lot? Shopify helps you do your thing however you cha-ching. Shopify is the global commerce platform that helps you sell at every stage of your business. From the launch your online shop stage to the first real-life store stage. All the way to the did we just hit a million orders stage. Shopify is there to help you grow. Shopify helps you turn browsers into buyers with the internet's best converting checkout. 36% better on average compared to other leading commerce platforms. Because businesses that grow, grow with Shopify. Get a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/work. Shopify.com/work.
Since 2013, Bombas has donated over 100 million socks, underwear, and T-shirts to those facing homelessness. If we counted those on air, this ad would last over 1,157 days. But if we counted the time it takes to make a donation possible, it would take just a few clicks. Because every time you make a purchase, Bombas donates an item to someone who needs it.
Go to bombas.com/ACAST and use code ACAST for 20% off your first purchase. That's bombas.com/ACAST, code ACAST.
There's never been a faster or easier way to start your weight loss journey than with PlushCare. PlushCare accepts most insurance plans and gives you online access to board-certified physicians who can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Take charge of your health and speak with a board-certified physician about a weight loss plan that's right for you. Get started today at plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss. plushcare.com/weightloss.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
This podcast is brought to you, as ever, by the New European newspaper. And I hope you know what the New European is by now, but you may not subscribe. And I just want to say, please do, because it's the best way to support our independent journalism. And this week, I have a superb offer for you, which is a free signed hardback copy of James O'Brien's brilliant book, How They Broke Britain. Have you read How They Broke Britain?
I have, and I think it's terrific.
Honestly, it's magnificent journalism,
well,
isn't it?
I can't recommend it highly enough.
And it'll make you
angry and think,
yeah, all of those good things. And we've got plenty of signed copies by the man himself, James O'Brien. And you can get a free copy of James O'Brien's book when you subscribe for just a little bit more than £1 a week, and you can go to theneweuropean.co.uk/2Matts to take that great offer up. Please do.
Brilliant.
And there's a link in the show notes. So, Matt, some amazing television on at the moment.
Yeah, there is. And I guess, you know, prime amongst it is Breathtaking.
Yeah.
Which is a series made by ITV.
They're on a roll, aren't they?
They are, and it's an extraordinary business because, as we, you know, only in January we were talking about Mr. Bates versus the Post Office with Toby Jones, which led to a change in the law, right?
Yeah.
And here we are talking about this three-part series. You can watch all three parts on ITVX already. And it's about the COVID pandemic and what it was like in a hospital. And again, this is another triumph for Polly Hill, who I discovered as the head of drama at ITV, who commissioned this. She commissioned the Post Office
did
one.
Did she really?
Yeah.
I hope she's getting a pay rise.
Damehood. Yeah. So you know, and we're coming up to the fourth anniversary of first lockdown, 23rd of March 2020, so it's very timely. It's based on the excellent book Breathtaking by Rachel Clark, who is herself a fascinating figure. She co-wrote it with Jed Mercurio and Prasanna.
Jed being the genius behind
Line of Duty, and Prasanna Pawanaraja, who is both of them former doctors, by the way. Jed Mercurio is a
former
doctor.
Really?
Yeah, so they're
no idea.
And Clark, Rachel Clark is very interesting because she was a journalist before she became a doctor.
Right.
And she was a very distinguished journalist for the BBC and Channel 4. And then in one of those sort of extraordinary, public service
epiphanies,
she went off and trained to be a doctor age 29.
How incredible.
So, and I can vouch, you know, during the pandemic, Rachel was a really brave and extraordinary person who was willing to talk to the media.
Yeah.
And, helped with, I was doing some podcast reporting on COVID at the time, in real time, and she really stuck her neck out, you know, on 4 hours sleep a night tops.
I presume she's based on the central character.
Yes, so Joanne Froggatt plays a doctor called Abby Henderson,
right,
in an unnamed NHS hospital, but it's very much based on Rachel's memoir, very closely, and as I recall of the book, pretty much everything that is said in the that is depicted in the drama is in the book or was in other well documented cases. And it's the usual story: shortage of PPE. You know, the Joanne Froggatt character is told you can buy a kit off Amazon.
Yeah,
I remember that.
Yeah.
Inadequacy of intensive care provision. So you have COVID patients in normal beds. Low oxygen alerts. I'd forgotten about that.
Yeah.
Discharge, and this is one of the biggies, discharging untested elderly patients back into care homes.
I've only already watched the first one, right? But by the first ad break, I am wanting to pick the TV up and throw it out the window because it is infuriating.
It is, and as you'll have seen, these dramatised scenes of what really happened are juxtaposed with Boris Johnson saying the testing service is fantastic and he's going to send the coronavirus packing, and Matt Hancock not even aware of how many nurses have died.
Yeah.
And it takes you back, it really is lions led by donkeys, these people, devoting themselves in the most appalling conditions and being gaslit by NHS England and by politicians, doing their best to minimise the suffering and death rates of their patients and also themselves. I mean, one of the things that's scandalous is that we still don't have a definitive number of how many health professionals died.
Yeah.
The Royal College of Nursing, I looked up this morning, reckons it was about 2,000, but we don't have a full figure yet.
I mean, there should be a memorial fund for those people, you know.
Absolutely, and I think, I mean, I don't know what you feel about this, but there have been some dramatisations already of COVID. There was do you remember the Kenneth Branagh as Boris Johnson?
That's right, it was very good. Yeah.
It was very good.
Yeah.
There was a very powerful drama in 2021 called Help by Jack Thorne, which had Jodie Comer and Stian Graham, about the horrors of care homes, which is just, I think, just unspeakable.
Yeah.
And then there was a not bad Partygate drama recently, last October. And you know, what's interesting to me is, I don't know what you feel about this, but I kind of feel that it knocks against there's a process at the moment of trying to move on, which I understand psychologically, but a more sinister, often conspiracist desire to kind of rewrite history going on about COVID. That were the lockdowns necessary? Were the vaccines properly tested?
Yeah.
And the COVID inquiry is good and necessary, but it's not sufficient. And I feel that these dramas are keeping the thing in the public mind.
There's two things I feel on the back of what you've just said. One is this extraordinary swing we've seen towards an almost instant impact from television drama. Because, you know, you can go back, amazing. We talked about it yesterday, you can go back 40, 50 years and social causes have been highlighted and brought to life through television drama.
We're great fans of that. You know,
all of that stuff. Yeah, you know, exactly. Amazing stuff. But none of those things had the immediate effect of the post office. I think Breathtaking is going to have a massive effect on how people see the behavior of the politicians at the time, because it is utterly staggering. So that's one thing, how television has sort of taken over the emotion and brought rage to
I think one of the things that I've certainly found as a journalist that I've moved away from covering Parliament just and Westminster to a much broader interest in politics and culture.
Yeah.
And I've thought a lot about this and why it is. And I think part of it is that culture is now playing a much bigger role in politics, partly because of the deficiencies of the political system and the fact that people don't trust it anymore. And I think culture abhors a vacuum.
Yeah.
There's a way in which these programs, these dramas are filling a gap.
Yeah.
And they're energizing people. And it does, again, it's something we've talked about before, you know, it's become commonplace to argue that people don't care about politics. They don't care. You know, they're not interested. I think they are disengaged from the political system. But, you know, look at the book charts over Christmas. Yeah, Rory Stewart's book was in the top 10. James O'Brien's book was in the top 10.
Look at the rise of political podcasts.
Of political podcasts. Yeah. You know,
Are engaged.
People absolutely are engaged. And I think that, you know, there's just looking this week, okay, another interesting, but I think we agreed, flawed TV series about a sort of dystopian imagination of what would happen if there was a state of emergency in Wales around Port Talbot Steelworks and what might happen.
Yeah.
We brought together by the sort of dynamic trio of Michael Sheen, James Graham and Adam Curtis. Can you imagine them all in a room? So there was that on BBC. You can see all that. The three episodes of that.
Yeah.
Then there's a great play on some of this. We've covered in the New European and the Culture newsletter. A Mirror, Trafalgar Studios with Johnny Lee Miller, which is a play about censorship. There's Enemy of the People's just opened, which is a modernised version of Ibsen's play with Matt Smith, which opens out the debate to the audience to talk about what's wrong with modern society.
Yeah.
And it's extraordinary. And I went this week to see Nachland at the Young Vic, which is about the new right and anti-Semitism in the Middle East. You know, and you can feel audiences engaging with these issues.
Yeah.
And I think there's something going on here.
Yeah.
Now, okay, theatre is a very selective audience because it's expensive, and you know it's skewed south, liberal, middle class, and all the rest of it. So, you know, you can't read as much into it as you can into telly. But if you look at the spectrum at the moment, there's a huge amount of amazing political drama. Why? And I think that's a very interesting and possibly quite optimistic,
I hope so,
phenomenon.
Yeah, I think so. And it makes me, my general feeling is that the traditional media, broadcast and newspapers, have got into a kind of cycle where they want to move stuff along and they're not necessarily reflective of how people feel. And so you get this latent swell of despondency or passion or, you know, deep interest in something like COVID, because actually if you looked at newspaper coverage of COVID over the last 12 months, you'd think it never bloody happened.
No,
you know, it just went off the agenda. And yet, of course, for millions of people, they were affected personally, directly, and for millions more, they're sitting there thinking, hang on, our lives were disrupted for 2 or 3 years, you know, and yet now no one's talking about it. Nothing's happened. There's no great plan for dealing with the next COVID thing. We've had a...
Well, not just that, but I mean, just going down the checklist, the Office for National Statistics COVID survey has been shut down. The recovery trial, which was promised great things, which was researching COVID therapies, is now essentially being funded by philanthropy, not by public subsidy. The one I still can't get my head around is the Joint Vaccine Task Force, Kate Bingham's outfit, has just been absorbed into another agency.
Yeah.
The UK Vaccine Manufacturing and Innovation Centre has been sold off.
Incredible.
All these things which were going to be the engine of preparing for the next wave have basically been dismantled or allowed to wither on the vine.
Because it doesn't matter this week or next
because
week.
Because it's
next
not, month. You know, there's an election and we want, and aren't tax cuts more important?
Yeah.
It's an extraordinary thing. But, you know, all hail ITV, all hail, you know, theatre producers who are putting on sharp political drama, more oil, you know, really good.
Yeah.
More power to their elbow.
And I must mention, because I've just seen it, because Amal Rajan mentioned it on radio this morning and interviewed the director of The After. Have you seen this?
No, I haven't.
18 minutes on Netflix about coping with bereavement. Absolutely superb and very moving.
Check it out.
So definitely worth checking out if you have a Netflix subscription. Thank you, dear listeners, for persevering with what has been a long,
big week.
But I hope interesting show. Please get your questions and any feedback as ever into twomatts at tnepublishing.com. That's the number two, M-A-T-T-S, at tnepublishing.com. Or if you listen on Spotify, you can message us there. And that's exactly what Jeremy from Denmark said, did. And he said, not a question, but to help TNE design a new beverage report. In addition to the Timmins book mentioned last week, see Danny Dorling's 2023 book, Shattered Nation. Well, thank you for that tip, Jeremy.
Yeah, thanks.
It's something we are actively working on, so we'll definitely check that out. We are back with a new Q&A episode on Sunday. Please remember our subscription offer. If you like this podcast, you will love The New European.
You will.
And it's the best way to support our independent journalism. So please head to thenew.co.uk/2mats. That's the number two, M-A-T-T-S, and you get that special offer. And there's a link in the show notes. Thank you to producer Matt Hill at Rethink Audio. And until next week.
It's goodbye from me.
It's goodbye from him. Goodbye.
Goodbye.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. Quince.com/style.
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/newsadfree. That's amazon.com/newsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.